You are listening to Mountain Money, broadcasting on KPCW, Park City, Utah. Good morning. You're listening to KPCW's Mountain Money. My name is Allison Kulo, and I'm here with my co-host, Roger Goldman. Good morning, Roger.
Good morning. It is a beautiful winter's day here in Park City, or at least that's how it feels. It's about 40 degrees outside and rainy and cold and wet.
You brought out the puffy jacket. I couldn't.
Well, I wanted to be comfortable because I wanted to settle in for what I think is going to be a really fun show this morning. Tell me who we got, Allison.
Well, today we're going to speak with Michelle King. She's a gender and organizations expert and director of inclusion at Netflix. She's also the author of The Fix, Overcome the Invisible Barriers That Are Holding Women Back at Work. Michelle's going to highlight how the pandemic and quarantine is impacting women and the extra stress around work-life balance it's imposing on working mothers at this time. Michelle's also going to talk to us about why inclusive leadership matters now.
Next, we're going to talk to Brian Kahn with Morgan Stanley, who's going to help us understand the socially conscious investment movement, as well as the direct relationship between corporate governance and the investment choices that we make.
And finally, we'll end the hour with Stephanie Samuels. She's the general manager at the Peaks Hotel. We're going to be talking with her about their Santé on the Lawn and their partnership with the Park Silly Sunday Market. All this and more on Mountain Money. Stay tuned. Welcome back to KPCW's Mountain Money. While COVID-19 has given parents more time with their children, their responsibilities at home have increased. On June 3rd, the New York Times ran a story headlined, "Pandemic Could Scar a Generation of Working Mothers." The article spoke to the impact of school, daycare, and summer camp closures on working mothers as women continued to do a disproportionate share of work at home.
While some working mothers are feeling as productive and even more productive from home, while also taking care of their children, other mothers have had to cut their hours or even quit jobs in order to be able to provide care to their kids. The impact of this period will last a lifetime, reducing a mother's earning potential and work opportunities.
To understand this further, Michelle King will join us. Michelle is a leading global expert in organizational culture and gender. Michelle is currently the Director of Inclusion at Netflix and former head of UN Women's Global Innovation Coalition for Change. She's the host of the weekly podcast, The Fix, which shares practical ways men and women can advance equality at work. Michelle, thanks for joining us on Mountain Money.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I'm excited to chat with you. I know that women in the workplace has been a topic that you've been following very closely, but I want to talk to you about what the impact of coronavirus has been on women's careers now and in the future.
Yeah, look, it's really a bit of a mixed bag, from my perspective. I think there's a lot of reports out showing, firstly, just how detrimental coronavirus has been on gender equality generally. So we've seen, women are at higher risk of domestic violence. We know that women make up 70% of healthcare workers. And so, that's incredibly challenging because they're at a sort of higher risk of getting coronavirus. We know that women face tremendous challenges in terms of managing dependent and childcare needs, and also they're at higher risk of losing their jobs. But, on the whole, coronavirus has been sort of very detrimental in terms of just women's mental and emotional well-being, right? Because, and health-wise, so managing all of that is incredibly challenging. At the same time, though, from my perspective, I think it's also showcased the attributes that we need in terms of women leaders. So when we think about, on average, women leaders tend to display a more democratic, relational, empathetic leadership style. And right now, that's the leadership style that we need, right? So in a COVID-19 world, you need leaders who are able to manage remote workforces, able to get their teams to collaborate. And it's really shone sort of the spotlight on the new type of leader that we need, not only today, but also in the future world of work. And so there are opportunities for women and for organizations to really support women to take on these leadership roles. But it really requires sort of creating more family-friendly workplace cultures.
When we talk about the sort of impact of the virus on women in the workplace, there really are at least two kinds of paradigms that we can talk about. One is, of course, the fact that many women are in service jobs, which have required, on-site participation at a time when there is a lack of childcare. The other is the white-collar or professional worker who is at home trying to manage a Zoom career while also managing the careers. Can you talk a little bit about the differences between sort of the way women have been able to deal with the latter situation, the stay-at-home Zoom situation, and what happens with men?
Yeah, look, I mean, I talk a lot about this in my book, actually. I think the challenge with working from home and obviously managing children and childcare, I've got two kids myself, so really understand this. It's impossible, right? I mean, I've got a 4 and a 6-year-old that come into every meeting. I'm hoping they don't jump on this call. Like, they just, you know, it's really challenging. And that creates, we know, sort of from an outcome and consequence perspective, a mental and emotional load, right? So we find there's this tax mentally as women are managing a million different things. They've got a really long to-do list, and that creates stress. It has sort of implications for their health and mental well-being. And then there's also the emotional load. So managing the anxiety that children will be feeling as they have to stay at home, they're in their house, they're getting frustrated with that. And so women, it's something that's quite interesting in the research we don't spend enough time on, is that women manage both these aspects. So it's not just time away from work in terms of having to care for children. It's also managing the mental load of the household, the dependent care needs, and then the emotional well-being of the household. And we find if women carry both the mental and emotional load on top of just time away from work, that is really the straw that breaks the camel's back. So, you know, that's where we need partners to sort of, if we're in the household, to support. And that's where really women need their husbands or their wives to really step in and support them with managing sort of either the mental or the emotional well-being of their children. It's just too much for women to carry that load. And I think for me, importantly, one of the things I've been advocating for is that organizations really try and see the whole person. You know, we need to encourage workplaces to kind of remove the stigma of childcare and dependent care. We know, for example, that if a child pops onto a Zoom call, women are going to be disproportionately penalized. They're going to be seen as less sort of serious about their careers compared to men, right? Whereas men, a child pops on and people are like, oh, that's so sweet. You know, there's his child, and he's seen as a breadwinner, right? Because he's providing for his family. It's almost a benefit. And so we need to try and remove these stigmas that are associated with sort of gender stereotypes, right? Where women are seen as less serious about their careers if they're caring for their children. That is the only sort of starting point for really beginning the journey to creating workplace cultures that support both parents, that kind of reveal all these other aspects of their identity. You know, they're not just the worker, they're parents, they're humans, they're in a crisis, they're managing all these different aspects, and they need workplaces that see that and accommodate it.
So as you've mentioned, the current situation of the pandemic is highlighting the way that workplaces don't really allow for flexibility regarding parents, whether that be a man or a woman. What are some pieces that could come into a management structure that could help this flexibility during this time? What are things that companies could look at to be able to help balance this need that parents have versus those without children?
Yeah, this is such a good question. You know, I've got some good news on this. The good news is you don't need a flexible workplace policy. And I really mean this. So studies have shown for years we've had sort of remote and flexible workplace policies, right? So policies in place to say you can work anywhere, you can be flexible. But what research has shown is, you know, even if you have that written down, even if you have that as an option for people, the reality is those policies are gendered. So they're seen as something that are created for mothers typically. And so there's a stigma that's associated with sort of taking that. So a great example of this is a research study that showed when men reduce their work hours for family reasons, they're going to face a 26% reduction in pay on average after sort of controlling for the usual factors that would affect pay. Women will face a 23% wage penalty. And the reason for that is, you know, men sort of, and that's why I always say it benefits men more than women, men are sort of typically seen as having to live up to this breadwinner image, should be really serious about their careers. And so they're penalized when they step away. And the same is true for women. But, you know, women, it's sort of to a slightly lesser degree because, you know, most people view women's careers as expendable because of gender inequality. And so the aim with this is to remove that stigma. And the one way workplaces can do this is by having leaders role model flexible working, having leaders talk about with their teams the importance of understanding our different needs and identities outside of work, and taking the time to check in with their teams and almost crafting a job and working out around an individual's needs. So we're seeing this right now with Zoom, right? So leaders really thinking through, you know, we need to reestablish boundaries. You can't be doing Zoom calls all throughout the day. If you've got kids, you need time away. You need to sort of balance your hours. And a lot of that comes down to really good management, really good leadership. And so for me, what COVID's really taught us is that we need leaders who are able to lead. We need leaders who know how to manage, to have these conversations with their teams, to support their employees with their well-being and identities outside of work. It's not enough to just treat employees as workers and adopt that sort of 1950s command and control style of leadership. That is gone. So, you know, this is a really an important moment for leaders, because if we don't get this right now, it will really sort of put organizations back in terms of managing some of the technological transformations like AI, robotics, nanotechnology that are forecast to come over the next 3 to 5 years, which require this much more democratic, relational, empathetic leadership style.
Your new book is entitled The Fix: Overcome the Invisible Barriers That Are Holding Women Back at Work. And I wanted to ask sort of, what brought you to write the book? And secondly, what do you think, how would you say if you were meeting with senior executives and who would say, look, we recognize we've got an issue here. What's the first step that you would take to try to overcome those barriers?
Yeah, thank you for asking this. You know, for me, I wrote the book because I've been researching for many years as part of my PhD, sort of why we had the lack of women in leadership that we do today, despite all these diversity and inclusion initiatives. And I very quickly realized it's not women that need to be fixed, it's workplaces, and particularly workplace cultures. And so I wanted to write a book that would demonstrate all the ways that workplaces are broken. And so my book outlines, you know, a lot of the different barriers women are likely to encounter over the course of their careers and how they can navigate that. But importantly, the book actually holds leaders and organizations accountable for creating these work environments that don't support women. And so for me, the starting point with this work is disrupting our denial around the different lived experiences people have in workplaces. So there's a general belief that our workplaces are meritocracies. Everybody experiences them in the same way because everybody's really just an employee. When they step into that office, you know, they leave their identities at home and they become the worker. And the reality is that's just not true. I mean, if anything, COVID really taught us that, right? Like, we have these identities outside of work. And so for me, the work starts with kind of understanding how we experience workplaces differently because of inequality, understanding that lived experience, understanding the day-to-day moments where exclusionary behaviors or discrimination happens. It might be a sexist comment or a sort of joke that's kind of, you know, makes people feel horrible. And so for us, this is really about understanding that lived experience of your workplace. And if you can do that, you know, if you can start to share those stories, share those different experiences, understand the lived experience of that culture, that is the starting point for disrupting our denial about this belief that it's a level playing field and we all experience workplace in the same way. We simply don't. And so for me, that is really the starting point of this work.
To look at it from a different angle, if I was a manager, I would say, well, shoot, this is going to take a ton of time. We're going to have special meetings. We're going to have to educate people. How is equality the key to innovation and survival? And why is it important that a company wants to take a look at that, even if things seem to be going okay right now?
I always laugh when I get this question because I'm like, that is the role of a manager. This is actually what my second book is on. So, you know, at least 60% of your job should be building a culture of what I call quality, right? An environment where people feel like they belong, they can be themselves at work, they can share their ideas, they can collaborate. And the reason this is so important is because, and there's a great study out now by McKinsey showing this called Diversity Wins. You can have a diverse team, right? But the reality is if they're not practicing inclusion, if it's not in the fabric, in the way that the company people behave and treat one another, you're not going to reap the benefits of inclusion from in terms of increased profitability, increased sort of productivity. You're not going to see that come out. And this really matters to your point on innovation. So when we look at, you know, what is the key driver or enabler of innovation? Cultures of equality. So there's an Accenture study that shows brilliantly that in cultures of equality where people feel like they belong, employees are 6 times more likely to have an innovation mindset. And that's because you're creating an environment where, you know, people feel like they can discuss ideas, they can openly share their different aspects of themselves, they can be themselves, they're comfortable voicing, speaking up, collaborating, problem solving. And to create that environment, you have to start with leaders. Leaders set the standards for behaviors in organizations. They are, in essence, the culture of an organization. So if your employees don't feel like they belong, have a look at yourself, have a look at the behaviors you're engaging in, have a look at the way you're managing those day-to-day moments where people are excluded or, you know, where they're ignored or overlooked. Have a look at the way that, as a leader, you're creating an environment where people don't feel like they can be themselves at work, and ask your employees, like, just reach out and ask and understand what that lived experience is like and how you contribute to that. That is the starting point for creating an innovative, collaborative sort of culture that really encourages belonging.
I really like the concept of disrupt denial. You know, for many years I worked in a large law firm, which, you know, 30, 40 years ago was very male-dominated. And when we would have discussions many years ago about the workplace, the notion was, you know, this is what's normal, right? And denial was this notion that, well, people need to learn to adapt to the realities of this workplace, not we need to recognize what differences are. And obviously that has evolved substantially over time. And one of the ways I think that it has done is this other concept that you introduced called get to know the barriers. Can you talk a little bit about what that means and how a good manager does that?
Yeah, look, there's really three things you can do to disrupt your denial. And I just want to say this, you know, we're all in denial to some extent. So I was in denial in writing my book about the barriers men face because of gender inequality or cultures of inequality. I thought that, you know, the environment works for men and it doesn't. And my book has a whole chapter on all the challenges men face because of cultures of inequality. So the current system doesn't work for any of us. And the reality is we've been kind of fed this meritocracy myth that it's a level playing field, you know, that we all experience workplaces in the same way. And so nobody's saying that, you know, if you've succeeded in your workplace, you haven't had to work hard. What we're saying is that, you know, for women and people from sort of underrepresented groups generally in organizations, they've had to not only work hard, but overcome a range of invisible barriers in doing so. And so the aim with sort of creating a culture of equality and supporting this work, you know, is to disrupt our denial around this. And that really means becoming aware of how workplaces don't work for everybody in the same way, how people experience the culture differently, and how the environment is sort of hardwired through some of these behaviors to not support everybody's advancement in the same way. And then, you know, with that awareness, sort of really leaning in and doing the work, like reading books like mine, there's, you know, a ton of resources out there, podcasts, to understand some of the barriers that people face because it differs, right? So I'm a white woman, and my whiteness makes it that much easier for me to advance compared to black women. And so it's really important to understand, and I've got a ton of articles and resources out on this, you know, the challenges that black women face and how, you know, they face gendered racism, and it's a lot harder to advance, and there's a ton of barriers associated with that. And so the aim is to develop that understanding because without awareness and without understanding, you can't practice equality. You don't know how to lead in a way. You don't know what some of those day-to-day moments are that black women are going to experience that create a barrier to their advancement. And so as a result, as a leader, without that awareness, you don't know how to show up in that moment. You don't know how to practice allyship, speak up and advocate and amplify, you know, black women, because you don't even know the barriers that they face. And so that is the problem we have today. How many leaders honestly know how inequality works in workplaces? And I have a whole chapter explaining it. If you don't know this, then it's going to be impossible to solve the problem. So start with sort of disrupting your denial, understanding how inequality works. And once you have that understanding, you'll be able to practice inclusive leadership and really build a culture of equality.
To take a look at it from the angle of the employee, I've done some work, and I understand Parker Palmer writes about kind of our disconnected self and how many of us act differently when we're at work than we do at home, and it's because of the values of that company or corporation. How do you, as an employee, when you start to feel this or when you're realizing that things are weighing down on you, how do you bring up this conversation to benefit yourself? Because a lot of times it feels a little selfish, or maybe it's just me feeling like this. How do you start that?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think the reality is, you know, one of the conclusions I kind of drew from my book is that, and I think most readers will, is that equality stands to benefit all of us. So a good example of this is, you know, if you're at work and you witness somebody being discriminated against or somebody being excluded, research finds that simply witnessing that, you know, will have the same detrimental impact as if you'd been on the receiving end of the behavior. Now, that's a really important point, because what we're saying is that actually, you know, this doesn't work for the person witnessing it, and it doesn't work for the person experiencing it, which is why, you know, creating an environment that supports equality, it's really about creating an environment that supports you to be more successful, because nobody wants to work in a work environment where people are being discriminated against or marginalized against, or very few people would want to work in that environment. And, you know, it's even then, it's not without its cost to the people that it's benefiting. So the reality is we need to create a work environment that works for everybody. What does that mean? It means creating a work environment where you feel like you can be yourself at work and be valued for that. And so when you're witnessing inequality, you know, I really encourage people to think about how to practice allyship, because that's the starting point for really turning cultures around and in a way that ultimately will benefit you. So for me, that's really about, once you know what the barriers are, so let's take the performance tax, knowing that women have to work so much harder in order to be perceived as equal to an average white male, and that that's even harder and compounded for black women. You know that when you're in a team meeting or when you're sitting, you know, in an environment where we're talking about people's achievements, you know, that's your opportunity to amplify women in that room, amplify, you know, members from underrepresented groups, because you know their achievements are typically overlooked or devalued. That's your opportunity to speak up. And so those are different ways to practice allyship in a way that isn't necessarily self-serving, but ultimately would benefit you, because you'll have an environment that practices equality. And so that's the aim, is really, you know, an understanding that your fight is my fight, and we're in this together, and we're creating an environment that will ultimately benefit you, but also benefit me. And I think for too long, we've engaged in sort of performative allyship, where we see male leaders sort of jumping up saying, you know, now they're going to lead equality, they're going to help women who obviously haven't been able to get there on their own. You know, that's the argument put forward, and that's inherently very misogynistic. The idea is to really understand that actually inequality doesn't serve any of us. So creating an environment where all of us can be ourselves at work and be valued for that is incredibly beneficial. And just very shortly, you know, there's a great study on this, again, by Accenture, that shows in cultures of equality, women are 6 times more likely to rise to senior leadership positions, and men are twice as more likely. And the reason for that is because we're no longer advancing a small number of people that fit sort of this outdated ideal that I talked about before, you know, this command and control, what I call the Don Draper from seeing Mad Men. You know, that's the ideal standard for what good looks like in workplaces. And it's very narrow. It's sort of a white, middle-class, heterosexual, labor body male. So anyone who doesn't fit that standard or engage in the behaviors associated with that standard is going to face challenges trying to advance. And so that's why, you know, that's at the heart of it, what creates inequality and cultures of inequality. And that's why, you know, disrupting all of that and creating environments where you can be yourself and be valued for that will ultimately serve to benefit all of us.
Michelle, we want to thank you for your time today on Mountain Money. Michelle King is the author of The Fix, Overcome the Invisible Barriers That Are Holding Women Back at Work, as well as a podcast with the same name. Michelle, thanks for joining us, and Mountain Money will be right back. Welcome back to KPCW's Mountain Money. COVID-19 has plagued communities and exposed gulfs in access to necessary resources. Through our frustration and desire to right inequalities, many of us have taken action to help mitigate and resolve these issues. One area that can provide significant impact is to align your finances with your personal and moral views through impact investing.
Environmental, social, and governance, or ESG criteria, help investors find companies with values that match their own. Environmental standards may include a company's energy use, waste, pollution, natural resource conservation, and treatment of animals. Social criteria look to the company's business relationships along with the safety and health conditions of employees.
Concerning governance, companies who use accurate and transparent accounting methods and provide stockholders an opportunity to vote on essential issues meet this standard as well. Governance can also include conflict of interest policies for board members. Here to talk about impact investing and the areas of environment, social, and governance is Brian Kahn, financial advisor with Morgan Stanley Wealth Management. Brian, thanks for joining us this morning.
Sure. Thanks, Allison. And hello, Roger.
Hello, Brian.
So, Brian, ESG investing seems to be a more significant priority for investors these days. What does ESG investing look like, and how long has it been around?
Sure. It's a great question. As far as how long it's been around, there are some specific instances in history that I can refer to. We can go back as far as the Quakers and their way of living and abstaining from alcohol, tobacco, firearms, and how that investment philosophy came along. Then Catholic bishops, there was a big movement there. Apartheid also helped to kind of move this along. And then it really came along with families. And we talk a lot about wealth transfer from an older family member, and maybe you have millennials, you know, is a hot topic, or a younger family member asking, why are we invested in this type of portfolio? And so it got families starting to talk about it. The Rockefeller Foundation, other large philanthropic families, they made decisions to have these family conversations and start to make some transitions as far as how they were invested. So it's been really, really neat to see what has brought it along. But I think a lot of it now is families are starting to talk about it and talk about it as a whole as far as what they're trying to achieve in their investment philosophy. And as far as what does you know, the priority look like, again, I think it's, we've had a lot going on lately. Michelle just talked a lot about it as far as inclusivity across the ESG spectrum. People are concerned about the environment. People are concerned about what the company that they're invested in, what they're doing with labor supply and different things like that. And then the G is the corporate governance side, is how is the company from a board and from a management, how inclusive, how diverse, how do they have the checks and balances in place?
Brian, are there examples where we can see that activist social investors have actually changed specific company behavior?
Sure, it happens a lot. And that's why, for all the listeners today, you have a say. When you purchase an equity, you're, you know, in a stock out there, you're a shareholder, and you do receive a proxy. You get to vote on board members and management decisions. And so we know the typical turnout in our elections, but it's the same thing for a publicly traded company. If you're going to go ahead and invest, you now have a say. And so it's very important to read what shareholder documents are coming to you and be able to have a say in that as far as decisions and direction for that company.
So with that, can an investor really feel connected through these companies and through those change? So if I were to invest in a company that had the environment as a high priority, are investors able to kind of feel like they're doing something positive for the environment, or is this more of a passive type of action that people take?
I would think so. I mean, it does depend on your investment level, and obviously there can be a little bit of a lean towards the larger size a portfolio may become. You really can get a little bit more granular and strip out some of the types of investments you don't want to include, or be really restricted as far as what you want to include. But something that's come along lately, it's the United Nations and their sustainable development goals. And there's been a lot of investment opportunities that will align with those sustainable development goals, whether it's specific to the environment, whether it's specific to poverty, banking to the underbanked. There's all different types of tranches or sleeves that you can really reach into if you know how to do the research.
And that's sort of where I wanted to go. If I'm an investor and I am particularly concerned with a set of criteria, and I come to you and say, mm-hmm. look, this is what's on my mind. I am very mm-hmm. concerned about environmental standards and companies that mm-hmm. adhere to environmental standards. How do you go about helping me find the way to tailor my investments to those goals?
Sure. I think I would start, Roger, with a little bit of the education, because obviously ESG, right, it's a hot topic, and E is the environment, S is social, and G is governance. And if you go into a typical ESG fund, you may get all of that. You may get a company that's carbon intensive, but they do a really good job on the other two, the S and the G side of things. They're, you know, from philanthropic views or taking care of their employees with the benefits and inclusivity, like Michelle was talking about. So from there, if you're okay and you say, okay, I understand, I have an ESG portfolio, I understand why some of those companies in there, I'm all right with it. I know that it's not going to be perfect from the E side, but if you said, I really, really want to focus on the environmental side of things, that's what I want to do with this part of my portfolio or all of my portfolio, that's where we can get, like I said, a little bit more granular and go into other types of funds that really get you to the goals that you have on that. It's not always perfect, I would say. But again, it depends on what you're doing with your portfolio, size of portfolio, and what you're looking to achieve. But it can be done.
Now, we're talking about the concept of an ESG fund. Okay, let's talk about who puts those together, what do those look like, and finally, what have we seen in terms of their performance on the financial side relative to funds who have no such values?
Sure. Obviously we can take like current times right now. Obviously, we all understand what's happening with COVID, and we know that there's a lot less travel, and we know that energy prices have gone down as a result. And we've seen energy prices go up as a result of other, you know, maybe it's related to war or other types of conflicts. So if you said, I don't want a portfolio with energy, you may be outperforming now, and you can see that, and you can understand that. Or in other times where maybe energy outperformed, and you said, I don't want any energy in my portfolio, you'd have to understand why you're underperforming and be okay with that. But as far as how they're built, obviously you have a company like Morgan Stanley that is very well known for offering a large amount of impact investments across what we call our impact matrix or investment matrix in that area. And then you have other fund managers out there that have been managing funds for decades now. Like I said, you know, you can go back to Quakers, you can go back to apartheid. The NAACP has been managing and following a fund that tracks inclusivity. So you have fund managers that have been around for decades. They've obviously been tracking their performance if they're going to be publicly traded and accessible to investors, whether it's in a college savings fund or in a 401k or in their IRA. They've got to have that track record so they can prove a track record over time, which, you know, you can go and search for and see against other benchmarks. But the nice thing is then you have that company that's offering that fund, and you're able to ask them questions and reach out or do it through an advisor like me and say, why would I invest in this specific ESG fund? What are they doing? What's their specific theme? Are they inclusive? Are they trying to exclude certain things? What's the ESG specific mandate? So you can get all those questions answered and know exactly why you want that fund for a part of your portfolio.
I've been an employee at a couple of different companies, and at those locations, we had 401k plans that the organization participated in. I know as well. I've got like a 529 for my child. Are these types of investment opportunities available in those arenas?
Sure. 529s, just on those, they're state specific. So every state has an agreement with a fund manager out there. And so you'd have to go and research where you had it, where, you know, a lot of people in Park City, I know, don't live here. And so they may have moved from, they're not from here, and they may have moved from another place. So they may have a 529 in another state. So you can go and search on that site to see what ESG investments are available for that 529. For a 401k, it's becoming larger and larger, just like Michelle was talking about. Obviously, if you have a company that does care about the G part, the corporate governance, or you have a company that cares about the environment, most likely that company, when they're doing their due diligence and offering a 401k, they're going to say, hey, we want to do best by our employees. So we know that our employees lean this way. We know it's important to them, and it's a part of their wellness of working here. So we want to make sure that we offer the type of funds that they're going to enjoy investing in instead of just, you know, offering these funds and not explaining why. So it goes back to the corporate governance side of that company of saying, if we want to hire and retain and recruit great talent, then we've got to make specific decisions. And one of those decisions in our benefits wheelhouse may be related to the 401k and may be related to the investments within that 401k. So that's a huge topic right now, is making sure that a 401k does offer the right type of investments for that specific employee demographic.
You talked a little while ago about the notion that any investor will get, in a publicly traded company, will get a little envelope at least once a year, which offers them the opportunity to vote on boards of directors and sometimes on shareholder initiatives. Now, as an individual investor, you might feel, wow, I'm really not going to matter much. And that's probably not a really good attitude to take. But if one thing I do know about publicly traded companies is that they pay very close attention to their relationships with funds, because they tend to have much larger holdings and their votes tend to matter more because there are so many of them. Are there examples where we can look to see where one of these ESG funds has actually taken that power, that voting power, and exerted it on a publicly traded corporation to alter behavior? Are you aware of any stories like that?
Sure. I those stories are out there where a fund manager has gone to a specific company and said, we would like to include you in our lineup, but we want you to clean up, whether it's labor supply or what you're doing on your carbon usage. And so absolutely, shareholders have that say, and it's coming from the bottom up. We hear it all the time where we have what's called advisor-led or client-led investment options. And so the more that the clients are asking questions, and the more that the investor is asking questions, it starts to move up that chain pretty quickly, and decisions can be made to include or exclude, because it can happen the opposite way, mm-hmm. where if the company didn't clean it up, they're not going to be able to stay within that ESG fund. So those mandates, and it's not perfect. Let's face it, if you went out to find organic food, organic coffee, clothing, there's just not one metric, one benchmark that says this is organic. And it's the same in the investment world. Is there are different metrics and benchmarks in companies out there, such as Sustainalytics and Morningstar. There are different ones out there that will rate and include or exclude certain companies on a ESG scale. So it's not perfect by any means, but at least you have the power and the resources to find out and dig a little bit deeper and ask why.
You know, one of the things that our last guest talked about was that equality and inclusion can actually enhance success. Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about the parallel question, which is, you know, as you look at your portfolio of fund availability, are there ESG funds that perform close to as well as funds that sort of ignore these issues and, you know, go for the bottom line?
It's been pretty similar. Like I said, it depending on if you're excluding or including and your portfolio is tilted a certain way, you may outperform or underperform, as there are certain sectors that do move around. But if you're pretty much aligned in the ESG fund and you're benchmarked to just the averages out there, and you have mm-hmm. the average technology or financials or other communication, and let's say it's a little bit of energy because it might be energy related to a wind inside that portfolio or whatever it may be. If it's pretty much aligned, you're going to see the performance be pretty similar. You may see it outperform, you may see it underperform here or there, but I think it'll be pretty similar, and we have the data on that to show. And like I said, it's a little bit tough, because what's going to happen is a lot of these inclusive companies as of late have been grouped in the tech sector. And if you have a tech portfolio, we know that tech has done very well as of late. And if you have a portfolio that is just mirroring that, and it doesn't have an ESG mandate, but it has a similar amount of tech and a similar amount of other of those sectors, then yeah, they're going to perform pretty much the same. So it just depends on what you're trying to include and overweight, or what you're trying to strip out and underweight, and then what some of the other funds that you're matched against and how they're doing.
But the bottom line, it sounds like, is that I can match my values to my mm-hmm. investments without really costing me a lot. In other words, that if I do it right, there is not a substantial tax, if you will, by choosing to pursue these kinds of goals in my investment strategy.
Correct. You shouldn't see a drag in your performance for doing what we would call mission-aligned investing, whether that's an organization and their endowment, whether that's a family foundation, or whether that's an individual investor, as Alan Simpson said, in your 529, in your IRA, in your company's 401k, you're not going to see a drag for mission aligning your investments.
You've mentioned that there's not a standard benchmark. So when one company may be having positive impacts on the environment, and side by side another company, their alignment or their benchmarks aren't counted the same at this point. But are there funds that everything is positive? They're good on environmental, they're good on social, and they're good on governance. Are there funds that are just ready to go?
Unicorns.
Yeah.
Right. And that's where you kind of move along the spectrum. And obviously that's where a larger portfolio might be able to diversify a little bit more into this and get a little bit more, quote unquote, I guess, sexy in the ESG space, where you can say, I want to go after a specific goal in mind, and it might be a private investment. And so that might take a little bit higher liquidity, higher net worth for that individual to achieve that, where they say, I want to go after, an example would be health and technology and education in developing countries. That may not be available necessarily for an investor that's just starting out, but that might be available for someone with, like I said, a higher net worth that can afford to do what's called almost a private thematic investing there. Whereas if you're just starting out and you say, I want to do it in my 529, I want to do it in my IRA, I want to just start with my general investment account. Yeah, across the ESG spectrum, like I said, you may get a little bit of all of that blend, and you may not be able to strip out every single bad or negative part of that investment mix.
Brian, I want to segue before we close. We've been talking a lot about ESG investment, but somehow I suspect that you're sitting in front of a computer terminal that shows the Dow up by some 400 some odd points this morning, notwithstanding an absolutely horrendous weekend about coronavirus cases around the world. Can you share with us any kind of observations about why on earth you think that's happening?
Obviously, we all know that the markets have been a little volatile as late, and that may not go away. Markets are forward-looking, and they're trying to digest a lot of news. We know that there's been a Federal Reserve stimulus, and that may continue. We know that there's low interest rates right now. So you do have to think about different things. Is where, when you look at your portfolio, are you getting what you need from bonds, which are related to interest rates and yield? Are you getting what you need from the income side there, or are you still in the growth mode? And so, you know, are equities attractive at these levels? Obviously, that's the question that all investors are asking. And what's going to happen down the road? Are we optimistic on a vaccine coming down the road? So there's a lot of different, I guess, intricacies to what's driving the market right now. And we know that there, you know, there could be a disconnect, I guess, from how certain people are feeling as far as the job market and things like that. But yeah, the markets are trying to digest and be as forward-looking as possible and see what a potential rebound, I guess, could be as far as not the markets rebounding necessarily, but from the economic fallout and what that recovery could be if things come around from a health standpoint.
Brian, thanks for kind of working through not just our current outlook for the market, but also talking with us about socially conscious investing. Thank you for your time today. Sure. So we've been speaking with Brian Kahn. He's the financial advisor with Morgan Stanley Wealth Management and Money Mountain Money. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to Mountain Money. My name's Allison Kulo. I'm here with my co-host, Roger Goldman, and we're going to be speaking with Stephanie Samuels. Stephanie is the general manager at the Peaks Hotel here in Park City, and she's here to talk to us about Versante on the Lawn and their partnership with the Park City Sunday Market. Thank you for joining us, Stephanie. Happy to have you. Stephanie, can you hear us? Uh-oh. Technical difficulties. Let's see if Stephanie can call back in, and we'll get her back on the air.
And while we're waiting for Stephanie, it was interesting to talk to Brian about, you know, socially conscious investing. And, you know, every once in a while we have a discussion about here on Mountain Money about why the stock market does what it does. And, you know, I don't think anybody really knows, although this morning's uptick is, again, somewhat perplexing to me. Allison, were you at all on Main Street on Sunday?
I was. And there was a huge rainstorm.
Yeah, so I guess this is not a good week to evaluate the long-term sort of financial impact of the closure of Main Street. The merchants, how do they? Do we have Stephanie?
Stephanie. Oh, yeah. Well, so if you don't mind, let's hop over to her. Stephanie, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Oh, so excited to have you. So, Peaks Hotel. Maybe we should just start off by saying, what are your operations right now? How are things looking?
Things are looking up. We are open, you know, abiding by the Summit County Public Health Order and new restrictions. Everything's pretty much open, mask mandatory, of course. But majority of our facilities are open inside the hotel at this point.
Stephanie, we want to talk about Versante, which I think would be of real interest to our local listeners. But first, driving down 224, I noticed that all of a sudden there are more cars in that parking lot over the weekend. Are you seeing an uptick in people coming to stay, and are they local? Tell us a little bit about what we're seeing in terms of the business profile on the hotel side.
Absolutely. It's changed. It's definitely been a changed dynamic. We call them the weekend warriors right now. We're seeing a lot of business coming up from the Salt Lake Valley or just people coming into town for the weekend, you know, losing the wedding business and the corporate and the group business and definitely the sports business now. That just seems to be our new clientele trend, are just people coming in. Usually we're getting the check-ins on Friday, and a lot of them are even extending through the weekend and just enjoying the outdoors. Our mountain bike locker storage is full. We're seeing people even in with their towing or bringing campers or everything else. They're just finding and staying a longer weekend in our town right now.
I've heard that the average daily rate of the lodging in town hasn't been significantly decreased. Is that the same for your property?
You know, no, we're right on where we were last year. Again, just to be a little bit more aggressive, throwing in, you know, other dining credits and things to, you know, excite people to want to come and stay at the Peaks. But yes, no, from what we're seeing from our hotel and our partners in town, the lodging, the rates are pretty much standard for summertime.
The rates are standard, and I know for some period of time we saw a lot less occupancy, and it sounds like we're getting some of that back. How would you compare weekday occupancy to prior years, though?
Weekday is off, definitely. We're definitely scaled back big time during the week. And a lot of that's filled up with, again, your corporate business, our sports team travelers, and that's what we've lost during the midweek.
I want to segue and talk a little bit about Versante, one of my favorite topics. Tell us a little bit about what you're doing special this summer at Versante.
We are. We're super excited. Versante on the Lawn kind of came about. It was a team collaboration after curbside dining. And once we opened up the restaurant and went, well, you know, there's a certain amount of our clientele and our guests and locals that aren't quite comfortable to dine inside yet. And what does that look like for us? Our deck space is very limited. And then we thought, well, if we put picnic tables on that side acre lot that we own, people can get their curbside pickup and go dine out there and still get a dinner and an experience outside instead of just taking their food at home. And then that just kind of progressed from there. We reached out to the UDABC and were granted an extension of our liquor license to Starve on the Lawn. So then came the fence, and then came the idea of partnership, and went, well, all these things that we enjoy as locals, we've lost this summer, understandably so, but, you know, we look forward to these things. And then we reached out to Silly Market and thought, hey, do you have connections? Can we connect with some of your vendors? We also have a back lot right there that we can give them a space to be outside and, you know, provide back to our locals and our customers to have them enjoy just a tiny bit of what we all love about summer here in Park City. So we've got three vendors on the weekends, on Saturdays and Sundays. And then we partner with Mountain Town Music, and we have local acoustic musicians playing on Saturday and Sunday as well. Thursdays throughout the month of July, we've partnered with Paint Mixer. So we have three Paint Mixer nights on the lawn. And then through August, we're partnering with Megamind Pub Quiz, and we're going to do a trivia night on Tuesdays on the lawn.
That sounds like so much fun. With regards to On the Lawn, talk to me about how food service and alcohol service works. Do you order from the restaurant and then carry it into the fenced area, or is there like a pickup table there? How does that work, and is it the full menu available?
The full menu is available. We actually have servers out on the lawn, but your food will come out contactless in to-go food. So you're getting your pizza in to-go boxes. You're getting your pasta and all your items in to-go boxes. So that way you can order on the lawn through a server. They put it in, but then your food gets delivered right to your table, picnic style.
Very nice.
The bar, we do have a bar on the weekends out there, but you can still get, we're doing canned beer and certain cocktails, just a very limited, skewed back liquor and beverage menu out served out in the lawn.
So I could see the wait staff could bring you a canned beer. What would they do about a cocktail? How would that be served?
We are doing cocktails, too, on the weekends. We've set up a bar for Saturday and Sunday. Now, during the week, we are going to limit it because we're going to have to be serving it and making it inside. Mm-hmm. But all of this is still pretty new to us. And as we feel the need during the week, if we have to open up the full bar 7 days a week, that's what we're going to do. I guess we're just kind of waiting to see what the locals want us to do at this point.
That would be a happy problem.
Yeah, exactly. It'd be a good problem to have.
And speaking of happy, traditionally Versante has had some sort of afternoon I guess the word isn't happy hour, specials, if you will. Are you doing anything like that this summer?
We are. What we've done is we've kept those 4 to 6 p.m. half-price appetizers and half-price pizzas that you can have out on the lawn, but we've just taken off Saturday and Sunday. It used to be 7 days a week, but because it's so busy on the weekend and with our partnership with all our vendors, we're just doing our happy hour Monday through Friday right now, and you can have those prices out on the lawn as well from 4 to 6.
And what about Sundays, just so I understand? We sort of left that out.
Saturdays and Sundays, no. Saturdays and Sundays, no. We paused our happy hour on Saturdays and Sundays.
I will have to say that it is a phenomenal value for a great pizza.
Good.
So this weekend was the kickoff weekend for the kind of cooperative agreement that you're working with Silly Market on. How many people did you see this weekend, and what were some of the positive highlights?
Well, our events permit caps us at around 100, and we stayed solid around that number throughout the entire night. So our hours are from 3 to 8 p.m. By 8 p.m., I mean, we were sending people inside Versante to go dine. I mean, we did have quite a bit of people. We've done social circles on the front outside of the fenced area so people can still come and enjoy music and enjoy the experience without having to dine with us. You know, we're in such a great location with Thames right there, Park Meadows. We have condos behind us. We had so many bikers show up, and you know, it was wonderful to see actually family and kids running around, and they actually enjoyed music and sat in some of those social circles. So that was really a surprise to us. We didn't know how many people were going to come just to enjoy what we were offering outside of dining. But no, we did really great. I would recommend the earlier hours between 3 and 5 were kind of our easiest time to get people in. We opened up earlier than our normal Versante at 4 because we thought the biking community, people are getting done a day of golf, would want to come and enjoy and be outside. So we were opening up early for that time.
We've been talking to Stephanie Samuels of the Park City Hotel. I'm sorry, of the Park City Peaks Hotel. Thanks for joining us, Stephanie, and I assume information on the various music and other programs will be available on your website. Is that right?
Absolutely.
Mountain Money. Let's see. Thank you, Stephanie, and for taking the time with us.
You've been listening to Mountain Money, broadcast on KPCW, Park City, Utah. For more information, please visit kpcw.org. Please take a moment and give us a rating on your podcast app.